Good. Okay, so I want to take a look at Dayenu. Now, a couple notes about Dayenu, which you see in front of us, is that Dayenu is not an integral part of the Haggadah, meaning that it is not something that appears in the period of the Talmud. It appears for the first time in the late period of the Gaonim. Sadia seems to be the first one to publish it in his Sidur as a piyut to say at the end of the evening. This is a nice song to along with other songs of praise, to sing at the end of the evening. Somehow, it made its way into Ashkenaz, and somehow it made its way into the Haggadot. It's not in the Rambam's Haggadah. The Rambam doesn't mention it. But by the 13th century, it became pretty popular in the Haggadot. And, of course, it's a staple of our Haggadah. Now, to give it a little bit of context, the place that it ended up in the Haggadah when it got into Magid is right before this, right before Source 1, which is a famous Mishnah. Here I have the Nusach of the Mishnah. We recite it in the Haggadah with other things, an expanded Nusach. And so one of the questions I want to ask is, why is it put there? But besides that question, I want to ask five questions. And the reason I want to ask five questions is I am trying to avoid asking four. You know, we should see what we can do about getting around the number four at the Seder. Now, the first thing is that if you take a look at Dayenu is actually two paragraphs. All right. I don't know if I can somewhere to make this smaller, you can see it on one page, but it'll be too small. But Dayenu is two paragraphs. The question is, why is Dayenu two paragraphs? Because you're listing the same things twice. So what's that about? And the answer to that is fairly straightforward, but I want to use that to spring into a different question. A more specific question. If you look at the introductory line, and it's, by the way, we all know this, although it's the line that everybody skips because people go, like to kind of riff it through, but that's the line, I highlighted it. How many ma'alot tovot that Hashem has done for us? Now, the word makom for God is also a little odd because makom is a rabbinic use typically in Midrash that we have. It's not typically used in liturgical settings. The other very famous place it is in Nichum Avelim, Amakom Yenachem Etchem. But otherwise, it's used twice in the Seder. One is Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu in two different places. And here, Kam Ma'alot Tovot LaMakom Aleinu. So why do they speak Makom instead of Kam Ma'alot Tovot LaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleinu or LaShem Aleinu? All right, but it might be that syntactically or metrically it works better. But the real question is, why ma'alot tovot? After all, we're listing kindnesses that God did for us. And if we're listing kindnesses God did for us, we should do kama chasadim tovim la'makom aleinu. That would be a no-brainer. That would be very easy. Why pick this unusual phrase, ma'alot tovot? All right, so that's two questions. One is, why are there two paragraphs? One of them, why ma'alot tovot? The third question I want to ask is, the evening is supposed to be about Yetziat Mitzrayim. And Yetziat Mitzrayim, if you watch I'll go back to the second list a little easier. Yetziat Mitzrayim ends at maybe like here at number 8. He took us out of Mitzrayim. He did plagues against them, plagues against their gods, killed their firstborn, gave us their money, split the sea for us, walked us through on dry land and drowned them, our enemies in the midst. That's it. The rest of this is not Yetziat Mitzrayim. The rest of this is journey through the desert and then getting to Har Sinai and then getting to Eretz Yisrael and building the Beit HaMikdash. So this list seems to be extended beyond the framework of the evening. Fourth question is, if you take a look at the list seems to be artificially inflated because there are at least two lines in here which are, well, we'll again look at this list. There are two lines in here which seem to be just variations of each other. So, for instance, Sipek Tzorkenu Bamibar Baim Shana, he fed us for 40 years in the desert. And the next one is Bechilanu Et Haman, he fed us the man. My kids always like to ask, how did Haman get into the Haggadah? But he fed us the man. Well, that's how he took care of us for 40 years. It's 9 and 10 are the same thing. And 12 and 13 is a very famous question, and there's lots of commentaries on it. He brought us to our Sinai and he gave us the Torah. Aren't those also the same thing? Meaning they're not the same thing, but isn't the whole purpose of bringing us to our Sinai, isn't that to give us the Torah? So it seems that there is an artificial extension of the list. So again, to review the four questions till we get to the fifth question. Why are there two paragraphs here? Why start with Ma'alot Tovot? Why does this list extend well beyond the parameters of Yitziat Mitzrayim? And why is the list artificially inflated? And the fifth question is the real question that everybody asks about this, which is, Dayenu, are you out of your mind? How could it possibly be Dayenu? Let's try that. If God had taken us out of the desert and not done plagues against them, Dayenu. Okay, that I buy. If we'd gotten out without plagues, fine. But skip down to five. If he had not split the sea, that would have been enough. No, it wouldn't have been enough. We would have been slaughtered there on the shore. Or if he had split the sea but not walked us through, well, then what's the point of that? And what's the Dayenu there? But eight is a real killer. If he had, seven, if he had taken us through, eight, if he had drowned our enemies and not fed us for 40 years, Dayenu. So we get out, the enemies are killed, we're out in the desert, and then we starve to death. That's literally Dayenu, but in English. It's very strange. So the whole phrase Dayenu, which is the popular word, the refrain of the song, is a very odd word to use here. Very unusual. So I have five questions about Dayenu, besides the Makom, which I'm going to actually circle back to a little bit later on. So if you, I'd like to start by suggesting the following. The evening is about one thing. It's about one thing repeating, and it's about one thing resolved. It's about one thing. If it's okay, I'm just going to mute everybody because somebody's got some sound going on that's distracting. And if you want to talk, just hit the space bar. Okay. It's about one thing, which is Yitziat Mitzrayim. Yitziat Mitzrayim means leaving Egypt and getting out. And watching watching the enemies drowned, and we're in the desert, and that's Yitziat Mitzrayim on one level. That's what the evening's about. Notice, by the way, that we consistently invoke the four phrases of Exodus, Votzeiti, Vitzelti, Vigalti, Lakalakachti, and we don't invoke the fifth, which is Veheveti, I'll bring you to the land, because that's not what this is about. It's about leaving Egypt. Okay. However, it's also about something bigger than that. It's about an event that repeats, because at a core sentence in the middle, near the beginning of the Haggadah, we recite, V'hi sha'am da'la avotenu v'lanu, that the events that we're about to study are not one-time events. They're paradigms for Jewish history. Not only one person tried to destroy us, Paro, but rather throughout the generations, there were people who tried to destroy us, and God saves us. And we're celebrating Jewish survival, if you will, Jewish invincibility, if you will, with God's help. So that's piece two. But piece three that we're celebrating is an act resolved. Because what is the resolution of Yitziat Mitzrayim? What is the purpose of Yitziat Mitzrayim? The purpose of Yitziat Mitzrayim and the formal storytelling that we're doing that evening is about Yitziat Mitzrayim. We throw in a hint and say, this is something that happens generation after generation. But we don't tell stories formally in the Haggadah of other generations. The Magid might add that in. The Baal Haggadah and everybody at the table may add in stories from the Shoah, from the Palmach and the Haganah, from the 73 war, etc. People may throw in stories, but it's not part of the formal Haggadah. But the purpose of this entire Yitziat Mitzrayim was not to get out of Egypt and end up in the desert. The purpose of Yitziat Mitzrayim was a very clear stated purpose. For God to fulfill his brit with Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. That's from the very get-go of Hashem's words to Moshe at the snap. I made a brit, and I'm going to fulfill the brit. And it's time to activate that brit. And that brit means that I'm going to make these people mine. I'm going to bring them to my home, which is Eretz Canaan. They're going to become sovereign in Eretz Canaan. And ultimately, they are going to be the beacon for the entire world to complete, to fulfill Avram's mission of being a blessing to the entire world. And the lighthouse that carries that beacon is called the Beit HaMikdash. So that's all part of the picture. That's what we want to ultimately have happen. Okay. So we have something interesting that happens in the Haggadah, which is more than a hint towards this larger scope of viewing the events of the evening as not limited to getting out of Egypt. And that is the following. Rabbi Gamliel says that you have to explain all three of the symbols at the table. Pesach, Maror, and Matzah. This is the order in the Mishnah. We'd say Pesach, Matzah, Maror. Pesach, Maror, Matzah. The three symbols. What I'd like to suggest is the significance of these three symbols and the reason they have to be explained. And Rabbi Gamliel's ancestor Hillel famously had a shita that it's not in that you have to eat the Pesach, Matzah, Maror in one bite, as it were. The shita of the Chachamim was at the same meal, have some Pesach, have some Matzah, have some Maror, al matzot, meaning with. Rehillel said al means on. You have to put the Pesach and the Maror on top of the matzah and eat it a sandwich, right? A hamburger bun, right? You got your bun, you got your meat, you got your onions and lettuce, right? There you go. And Rabbi Gamliel then comes along and says, and now you have to explain these things. Why is that? So I'd like to suggest the following. The evening is the evening of all of Jewish history. And every moment in Jewish history is made up of moments that we can typify as Maror moments, Pesach moments, and Matzah moments. Every major event in Jewish history can fall into one of those three. The truth is, every major event in Jewish history falls into two of them, Pesach or Maror, and Matzah is a process. I'll explain. Let's start with the easy one. The easy one is Maror. That's very easy. Maror is bitter. They embittered our lives. Do we have moments in Jewish history that we could call a Maror moment? Unfortunately, that's too easy for us to recall. Auschwitz is a Maror moment. The auto de fe is a Maror moment. The Crusades is a Maror moment. The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is a Maror moment. Beitar is a Maror. We have, unfortunately, long lists of Maror moments. We have big Maror moments, like the Shoah, and we have smaller Maror moments, like certain terrorist attacks, etc. But Maror moments. What's Pesach? And Pesach is the second easiest one to explain. What happened? Why is Pesach called Pesach? What is the Korban Pesach? Why is it called that? Because we were sitting in our homes, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu protected our homes, or jumped over our homes. Two different interpretations of Pesach. So we are in a house as slaves, well, now to be freed, eating the Korban Pesach, and next door there's screaming going on, and every house there's screaming going on because somebody's died. In the meantime, we're protected, and we're celebrating, and we're having a feast. This is royalty. Royalty is not just having things good, but having things exclusively good. If you have a kingdom where everybody's a king, nobody's a king. Think about that. If everybody's prime minister, nobody's prime minister. I'm taking a page from Golda's old joke to Nick's. Being a king doesn't just mean that you have all of this power. It also means that you have that exclusively, that there's an intimate, special relationship between you and God that others don't have. That's what Pesach is. And we even say that when your child says to you, Ma avodah zot lachem, what do we answer? Zevach Pesach hu l'Adonai asher pasach habatei bnei Yisrael b'mitzrayim b'nogpon mitzrayim b'pateinu itzil. It is a Korban Pesach because when Hashem killed all the Bechorot of Mitzrayim, he passed over or protected our houses. Pesach is about royalty. Do we have Pesach moments in Jewish history? I think it's fairly easy to point to them. 1948 is a Pesach moment. July 4th, 1976 is an amazing Pesach moment at Tebbe. 1967, when the dust cleared, is an amazing Pesach moment. We have moments in our history, the day that Shlomo dedicated the Beit HaMikdash, Pesach moment. These are moments in which the whole world sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people are Am Yisrael, and he loves them and he's blessed them. That's Pesach. Matzah is trickier. Because who eats matzah? Maror is bitterness. Pesach is royalty. What's matzah? Matzah, although we identified at the beginning as slave food, is also refugee food. Typically, we explain matzah because they didn't have the chance to let stuff rise because they had to run out of Mitzrayim. That itself is very difficult in the Parsha. And therefore, matzah, by the way, which is very good road food because it doesn't go bad because it's never very good. Matzah is the refugee. Now, what's the refugee? The refugee is somebody who's leaving Maror but isn't at Pesach yet. It's somebody who has extricated himself or been extricated from the hellish situation of oppression, imprisonment, whatever it may be, but hasn't yet reached royalty. Rav Amital Zatzal used to comment that our generation is a generation of achshavistim. Achshavistim, nowers. He said everybody wants Mashiach achshav, Shalom achshav. Everybody wants everything now. And I don't realize that what Judaism is about, what Avodah of Torah Mitzvot is about rolling up your sleeves and doing the work. And doing the work knowing that you're getting from point A towards point B. And if you don't get all the way towards point B, then you leave that to your kids to do. That's what our avodah is, and that's what we're going to call matzah. Okay, so now if you take a look at the list, you'll find something interesting. The first five items on the list are all take place in Egypt. He took us out of Egypt. He did plagues against them, plagues against their gods, killed their firstborn, and gave us their money. That's all in Egypt. That's Maror, Egypt. The next five are all part of the road. They're part of the road. He split the sea. He walked us through. He drowned our enemies. He fed us and he fed us man. That's the sea. That's the desert. That's the road. That's the journey from Maror to Pesach. And the next five are all about the exclusive relationship that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He gave us Shabbat. He brought us to Har Sinai. He gave us the Torah. He brought us there to Israel and he built the Beit HaBechira. Notice, the Beit HaMikdash is here called the house of chosenness. And so what the author of Dayenu has done is elegantly put together the three components of Pesach, not in the order that we say them, because we say them in the order of primacy, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, but in the order of the way they happened. We start with Maror, then we go through Matzah, and then we end up at Pesach, and he walks us all the way through from being slaves in Egypt to sitting in Yerushalayim eating a Korban Pesach with the built Beit HaMikdash on top of the hill. Pretty powerful. So we can sort of understand what the list is about. But why is the list conflated the way it is? So if you see something interesting, in source 2, the Mishnah in Masechet Sukkah describes the celebration on the 15th of Tishrei, or during that week, in the Mikdash, when the Levim would sing at Simchat Beit HaShoeva. And they would sing standing on the steps that go up from the women's courtyard up to the men's courtyard. And those steps are called Chamesh Esrei Ma'alot. The 15 steps, but they're called Ma'alot. So the author here is doing, in one shot, so we say in two ways, one shot, by making a list of 15 items and by calling them ma'alot, he's creating an immediate association for us with the Beit HaMikdash. He's giving us a feeling that we're in the Beit HaMikdash. There's the 15 ma'alot, the 15 steps, and they end with the Beit HaMikdash. He's creating a strong sense of conclusion and resolution, and we're all the way there. We're celebrating not as people who are going to say L'shana Abba Yerushalayim. That's later on. Right now, we're in Yerushalayim. Right now, we're there, and that's why he uses the word malot and conflates the list to 15. And elegantly, as 15 are divided 555 by each one of the prongs of the celebration. So why is this two lists? Why is it two lists? And I'm going to address both of those questions, those other two questions together. We understand now why it's Malot Tovot. We understand why he completed the list. We understand why he got all the way to the Beit HaMikdash. But we still have the two questions, which is, why are there two lists? And Dayenu? So I'm going to tell you a story. And this story will illustrate both things. And it's a story about a woman who came to Los Angeles in the 1920s as a young newlywed with her husband. They were originally in the German community in San Francisco, which was older than the LA community. And they came down to LA. As you know, the Orthodox community in LA is fairly young. And as part of the very, very few Orthodox people in LA, she came to LA. They were living, this is before Boyle Heights, so living downtown. And she realized they can't live here without a mikvah. I'm a newlywed woman. Now, this is part of something that's not all that well known, but is well documented, which is there was actually a movement of tshuva among young German Jews in the 1910s and 1920s. So this woman, who had the unlikely name of Mrs. Hatzenflatz, ended up here in LA and needs a mikvah. There's no mikvah. This woman had a lot of moxie. So she went around door to door, talked to all of her neighbors who were German Reform Jews, the people who started Union Bank, by the way, and finally was able to raise enough money to buy a little house in the neighborhood and to dig a mikveh out. And being LA, they had to wait quite a while until they got enough water. They got enough water, and that's the first mikveh in LA. She built it. She used it. She convinced a few other women to use it. Okay. Baruch Hashem, she and her husband were blessed with two children. And when the it was now the 1930s, and she had to work like everybody else had to work with depression. So at that time, things started to open up called child care centers. And it was a phenomenon of that time. And so she realized that all the child care centers were run by lovely but very religious Christian women who had crosses on the wall and had the kids saying prayers and talking about Mr. T, right? This guy. So she said, I can't have that. So she went around door to door and convinced the people, and they took the front room of the house that they had the mikveh in and turned it into a child care center and hired a child care, a Jewish child care person to take care of the kids. Beautiful. Long story short, when her kids got a little older and she realized there was only public school, she said, you can't have that. And she started the first day school in LA. And after sixth grade, they could no longer maintain the day school. So she started a program. Again, she went around and started the program for a Hebrew high school for kids to go to high school after hours and study like cheder. Happened around the country in the 30s and 40s. And finally, when her kids went to school, in those days, everybody went to UCLA. You guys remember that? And when they were there, there was absolutely no services for Jews on campus. So she started a little program that later became the Hillel. Okay, her kids moved away. Her husband passed away. She was a widow living in LA. She was getting quite old. And in the 1970, some people decided that we don't know how long she's going to be here. We have to honor her. So they decided to have a dinner in her honor. And long story short, here's how the dinner played out. The guy who won the job to be MC of the dinner did it because this is what he proposed and this is what happened. Everybody came to the dinner, and he got up at the dinner and he said, if Mrs. Hatzenflatz had only built our first mikveh and nothing else, we would have this party in her honor. Everybody here in the room who has ever benefited from one of the mikvot in LA, please stand up and start clapping. So a few women got up. It's kind of embarrassing. They started clapping. And then he said, and if she had only built the first Jewish daycare center, but not the first Jewish day school, then we would have reason to have this dinner for her. Anybody who's benefited from a day school, get up from a daycare center, get up and cheer. If you're already standing up, get on a chair. Long story short, by the time he got to the Hillel program, people were swinging from the chandeliers. 2,000 people in the Century Plaza Hotel were screaming, Hatzenflatz, Hatzenflatz, Hatzenflatz. They brought her to the front, gave her the award. It was a beautiful evening. That's Dayenu. What does Dayenu mean? Dayenu means that we're having a Thanksgiving dinner to thank God. We would have this Thanksgiving dinner even if God had only done one of these things. Each one of these things alone merits a Thanksgiving dinner. Splitting the sea for us. What an amazing thing, Thanksgiving dinner. We're not isolating it in reality, because if he splits the sea but lets the enemies get through, that doesn't help. We're isolating it as a phenomenon. Had God only split the sea for us, it'd be worth a Thanksgiving dinner. Now you understand why you have two paragraphs. First, we list the if only. And then we say, how much more so that he did all of these things? At our table, this is the big paragraph. This is the one where we start cheering. How much more so? Hots and flats. This is where all the praise comes. And now you understand what Dayenu means. Dayenu doesn't mean it would have been enough for us. It would be enough to obligate us to have this celebration, to thank him with a full-throated Shirah Chadashah.